This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, beginning the oral history interview with Colonel Jim Hall and his wife, Minnie Mae Hall, who is also here with us. We are all sitting in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech. Today is the 24th of March, 2005, and I want to first of all thank you, of course, for visiting with us here and for agreeing to participate in the program and be such wonderful supporters of the Oral History Project and the Vietnam Archive. Jim, if I can, let me begin by just getting some biographical data onto the record. Could you tell us where you were born and when?
I was born on a farm just north of Greenville, Texas, which is about 50 miles northeast of Dallas, Texas. On April 8, 1919, my mother's parents lived there, and that's why I was born there, although my mother and dad and lived in Greenville.
Now, how long had you had parents on or family members on your mom's side here in Texas? Does this go back a long way?
My grandparents moved here before the turn of the century. They moved to a little town called Segal, Texas, down just southeast of Waco, where my mother was born. And then they moved to Kingston. This is the farm community I mentioned, just north of Greenville. I don't know what year, but she went to school in Kingston and finished high school there.
Is that right? Now, where did your grandparents move from?
My grandmother was from Mississippi, and my grandfather was from Alabama. That was their name was Horton.
Okay, spelled like you would think, H-O-R-T-O-N?
Correct.
Any military background for any of those folks that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I don't think they were involved.
Now, did you have brothers and sisters, Jim?
I had one sister. She died in 1979.
What was her name?
Gwendolyn.
Okay. And what did she do? Did she stay in Texas?
She stayed in Texas. She married a Navy man from World War II, and his parents lived in Lytle, Texas, just out of San Antonio. She moved to San Antonio when they married, and he became president of a bank down there, and she passed away down in that area.
She had an interesting career, too.
What did she do?
She was a teacher.
And, and a postmistress.
And a postmistress.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, good for her.
Yeah, she did.
In Lytle.
Now, where did she qualify to become a teacher?
At Howard Payne and Brown Board.
Okay. How did she come to go to college then? Did she pay for that or?
No, it's a long story. And if I'm getting off base here,
it's fine.
My mother and father were divorced when I was 8.
Okay.
And she was 3 years. My sister was 3 years younger than I. And when my mother and father divorced, my father moved to Dallas from Greenville and left us stranded. My grandmother and grandfather had sold their farm in Kingston and moved to Commerce, Texas, just again east of Greenville, and established a boarding house for young ladies attending East Texas State University. Wasn't a university at the time, but
college.
And my mother moved there, moved us there with them, and she moved to Dallas to try to find work. She had no experience in anything. She was a good seamstress. And she got a good job, not a good job, she got a job as a seamstress in a dress factory in Dallas, a so-called sweatshop.
You mentioned that, yeah. Do you know what the name of that company was?
It was Marcy Lee.
Okay.
And I don't know, company, corporation, whatever. But it's gone now.
Sure.
But she worked 6 days a week, at least 10 hours a day. And some weeks during the Depression, she made as few as $6 a week. So we lived on that until I got old enough to begin to earn a little money mowing lawns, working in a grocery store, filling station, carrying a paper route when I was 14. And my sister, then, Helen, and I went on to high school. and got out of high school, but I didn't go to college because there's no money. And I didn't know anything about earning big money enough to go, and my mother didn't have any education to try to get me along that line. So, sure. But I had a good friend who was a tile setter and got me a job as a decorative tile setter's helper and eventually an apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to go back to my sister, she came along 3 years after I did, and she established contact with my father, who then gave her the funds to go to Howard Payne. But he never did. I never did contact him. He never did contact me until I actually was drafted into the service, and he realized he had a namesake.
Okay.
And then kind of took an interest in me, and then continued on after World War II, during World War II, and after World War II, we became close.
That's an incredible story, actually.
So that's how my sister got her education.
Okay.
Was because she got back in contact with me.
Okay.
Long story around.
Well, no, it's a very interesting story. Now, I'm going to ask Minnie Mae now some of the same kinds of things. Where were you born?
I was born in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, uh-huh.
Love Field now has enveloped our home place. It expanded, and we lived on Lemon Avenue, and Love Field had to grow.
Uh-huh.
So we moved to Irving.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. And what about your family?
Well, I was born, coincidentally, on April the 8th, 1922.
No kidding.
He tells everyone how old he is, but it's not true. But anyway, I went to North Dallas High School,
mm-hmm.
and 2 years I was in the Irving High School because we moved there to my mother inherited her people's farm out there.
So you would have graduated from Irving then?
No, I went my freshman and sophomore year in Irving.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then I went back to Dallas.
Okay.
And graduated from North Dallas.
And what year was that?
I graduated in June of 1939.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now,
I did not go to college.
Mm-hmm.
I had two older brothers. One became a lawyer in Dallas, and the other one went to A&M, and then he joined the Air Force. And I lost two brothers in World War II. And one was a pilot in a B-25, the younger one, and the older one was a bombardier on a B-24, both in the European section of the war.
Now, Minnie Mae, do you feel like you could tell me anything about those, about where they were serving?
Well, I think my husband probably knows more about, we know a lot about them now. We didn't know anything at first. They were just missing in action.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And it took about 50 years to find out about one of them.
Which, what was his name?
You want to tell her all this?
Yeah,
he's better on words.
Okay.
Harry Jr., Harry Clay Jr. was
C-R-U-P
the older.
C-R-U-P was the last name. Trump.
Okay.
C-R-U-M-P.
Uh-huh.
And following him was Walter Pershing Crump.
Name for the general.
Sure. And now, tell me first about Harry.
Okay, Harry, let me tell you first about Walter.
Okay, sure.
His nickname was Bitsy.
Okay.
And he joined the Air Corps in late 1940,
mm-hmm.
and became a pilot in 41, and they sent him to Brazil for some kind of action, we don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
He came back to the United States in 1942, mid-1942, and was reassigned to Columbia, South Carolina, B-25 training organization, and from there went through Europe and through England and down into North Africa.
Okay.
Into Algeria, while Rommel was still in charge of North Africa.
Okay, so 43.
February.
Yeah, he
February 43. February. And he was lost on a bombing mission over either Algeria or Libya. We're not sure exactly where he was shot down.
Mm-hmm.
But several years, and we never did know any details about that.
Mm-hmm.
Several years later, am I getting too...
No, this is wonderful. This is very important.
Several years later, I read a reading an article in a magazine, Air Force magazine, said something about B-25s in the Mediterranean. So I contacted the publisher of that book and asked who I could talk to about the author, if they could tell me. They gave me the author's name. He was actually the secretary of the association of the bomb group that Bitsy was in. And he said he published either a monthly or quarterly newsletter. And he would put in a note in that we were interested in finding out something about Walter Bitsy Crump, who flew out of Algeria in 1943 and was lost. As a result of that, we got about three letters from people who knew him. We had phone calls from a couple of people, one who was actually his wingman when he was shot down. And that told us what happened. He got hit directly by an anti-aircraft fire, and the airplane exploded, and he went down. After the ground forces had moved Rommel out of that area, the wing commander sent a team out to see if they could find any evidence of what might have happened.
Right.
And in that Arabic country, everything had already been picked over, and they don't know what happened to the
bodies
or anything.
They never got any evidence.
No.
None whatsoever.
But you heard the wingman tell you the eyewitness.
That was so nice to talk about.
I believe that probably was. Mm-hmm. That probably was
after about 50 years, wasn't it? Wasn't it a long time afterwards?
Yeah, a long time.
And then later, I received a telephone call one Sunday afternoon from a history teacher from Grand Prairie, Texas. And he had been to an estate sale and found, he bought things pertaining to the war. And we had both of our names listed in the Dallas telephone book because we lived there for years. And there is a set of books called The Fighting Men of Texas. And on one page is my two brothers, Jim and my other brother.
All in a photograph together?
Photographed together. And a little bio there, and it said Jim Hall was married to Minnie Mae Crump, who was sister of these three men. Well, he bought these books or had these books, and this teacher looked in the Dallas phone book, found my name, called us up, and he had bought all kinds of pictures and award certificates and medals and everything that had belonged to my brother. He had married in right before he went overseas.
Okay.
She had died not too long after that.
Uh-huh.
Her family had all this, and why they didn't return it to our family, I'll never know. But anyway, he bought all this, and we met him, and he wanted to give all this to us. And I said, no, that's yours. But he had copies made. So we have that.
Okay, well, that's very nice.
Wonderful. That kind of tied it all together for us.
Yeah, that was a wonderful phone call and a very good thing he did. A very good thing he did. Yeah, good for him. Now, do you know much about Harry then that you can tell me?
Again, we knew very little about him.
Well, go back and tell her what he did before he went into service.
I will.
Yeah, sure.
He graduated from the University of Texas Law School and established a practice in Dallas with a young partner, friend of his. And when Bitsy was lost, Sonny is Harry Jr.
Before that. But when Bitsy went into the Air Force,
I'm going to tell him. Sonny closed his law office and went into the Air Corps.
Now, he enlisted. He wasn't drafted, I take it.
That's correct.
Okay.
And he wanted to become a pilot, but he couldn't pass that exam, so he became a bombardier.
Now, was there a physical issue with him?
Usually eyesight or something like that.
Right.
It could be so much as color blindness.
Exactly.
That doesn't disqualify as a pilot.
Right.
And he became a bombardier, B-24. And his wing was stationed in can't think of the first name, but it's in eastern Libya.
That's okay. We'll
Benghazi, I think.
Okay.
But I'm not certain right at all. And they were on the Plasti bombing raid, and were quite damaged in aircraft fire over the target, but came back from Romania through Italy to come back to their base, and leaving the boot of Italy over the Mediterranean, some Luftwaffe fighters got them and shot them down. They ditched into the ocean. And for a year, for a long time, their parents knew he was dead, or knew he was missing in action, mm-hmm. knew nothing of the details. But when the war was over, his pilot and co-pilot and engineer on the B-24 had survived the ditching. They did not know what happened to Harry Jr., because with all of the damage that had been occurred to the airplane, for bailout or ditching, they have a bell that they would ring to with certain signals to say we're going to bail out, we're going to ditch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know whether he ever heard any of this or not, because the wiring might have been damaged. But anyway,
sure,
they didn't know exactly what happened to him, but they were in a life raft together. The engineer subsequently died, but the two pilot, co-pilot, were POWs. And the pilot came to Irving, her mother's parents' home, and, I mean, you know, her parents' home,
mm-hmm.
and briefed them on as much as he knew about it. But later, many years later, when we were living, I'd already retired, we were living in Granbury, a good friend of ours was our postman became a good friend of ours, and he was a B-24 crew chief, and they had a big reunion in Fort Worth. And I said to him, "Will you check around, see if anybody knew anything, Harry Crump?" And he came back to me one day, and he called me from Fort Worth in Granbury and said, "Hey, I've got his co-pilot." So we set up an interview with the co-pilot at that reunion.
Uh-huh.
Her sister came down from St. Louis, and we all three sat in and got his details that I've told you up to now. And he never did know what happened to Harry Jr. either. So
now they were picked. They were in a raft, and they were picked up.
The co-pilot engineer had died in the raft.
He died.
But the other two were picked up and POWs.
Now they were picked up then by a German or a
German,
Axis surface ship.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For some reason, after the war, they were not friends anymore.
Something must have happened.
There was something. I wondered if the co-pilot might have tried to do something differently that the pilot did, or I don't know.
Something happened, uh-huh. but they were under extreme, mm-hmm. extreme circumstances.
Yes.
I can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. Do you know where they were held as POWs?
No.
I really don't.
Okay.
But it was nice that we finally found some of them.
Yeah. It's incredible, actually.
Many years.
These reunions are pretty useful for families who.
But you know, the unfortunate thing is about things like that. So many parents never were able to find them. Mm-hmm. We were just fortunate enough. Incident.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my parents didn't know about this.
No, they didn't.
They were already gone.
Now, you have a sister as well.
Yes.
So do you only have the two brothers?
I had three brothers.
Three brothers.
The other is younger than I.
Oh, okay.
And he died about, I guess, 6 years ago. He was a county judge in Lenox, Texas,
uh-huh.
Somerville.
Uh-huh.
But he joined the Army, and he could not go overseas because of the loss of the other two brothers.
Right.
And that grieved him.
Yes, I can.
But I had Betsy's married. We married on July the 25th, and Betsy and Anna Lee, his girlfriend from Irving, married the week after. And she went with him to South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and then he went overseas. They were just together about, what, 3 months mm-hmm. before he left. And then he was lost in February of 43. And 6 months later, Harry Jr. was lost. So that was a double whammy for the parents. But
well, and for you.
And yeah,
sure.
And then, of course, he was over there fighting all these wars, and I didn't know if I'd ever see him again.
Well, that must have been extremely...
But I didn't really worry, because I thought, what's to be is to be.
Is it, was that what you thought at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think most young people your age thought that? What, during the war, what will happen? And
well, I don't know about everybody, but...
More so than today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were much, I wouldn't say stronger, but, I mean, I expected him to do what he had to do.
Well, the situation with World War II was much different than what we're experiencing today.
That's right.
It was, we've got to be involved to stop this expansion of Nazism. We've got to be involved to stop the imperialism of Japan, or we're not going to be a free nation.
That's right.
And that was the focus that we had right here. And, you know, we honor Veterans Days and veterans and all of that, but in anything I've ever involved in along that line, I always say I was an active war veteran, but you were an active war veteran also, because without teachers, without doctors, without farmers, all of those, with and the production line people, she was roasted. Without all those kind of people, we would not have been. We wouldn't have had any support to them in the war. It is remarkable where our country came together in those days, whereas today, if we need a new weapon system, it takes 10 years to get it on the ground, that type of thing. So it was a much different situation in those days. Everybody contributed toward gaining the possibility of freedom.
And to what do you attribute that, the fact that everyone came together? Was it that the mission was so clear?
I think
it was clear.
No doubts. No anti-war.
We had to. If the Nazis had taken England, and the Japanese were already taking all the Pacific, we were an isolation nation at that time anyway. Mm-hmm. And eventually, there would have been trying to override us over here in our own country, unless, and our Congress at that time was very opposed to any kind of outside war.
That's right.
Fortunately, Roosevelt Churchill got together under the table, so to speak, and had some agreements that Congress wasn't even aware of, and were able to save us.
Now, go ahead, Nancy.
I was just going to say, the scrap drive, scrap metal.
Mm-hmm.
Mother and Daddy gathered up everything they could find around. They didn't farm. It was a small thing she had inherited over the years. And they went down around the barn, and they gathered up anything that looked like metal, gave it to the collection. Everybody had victory gardens. They grew vegetables and everything. Of course, it was rationing, and everybody... I had to be very conservative with gasoline, tires, sugar, coffee. Everything was rationed.
And it applied to everybody.
Oh, yeah.
There wasn't
service. That's right. And the women, while he was gone, I stayed with my parents. And they had a women's corps. I've forgotten what we were called. But we went to meetings, you know, to find out what we could do and all that. And it was just a different world then.
The atmosphere was very different. Now, I want to ask how you two met.
Can you make a short version? You know, men don't like
no
details. And women like me go into too many details. So I'll let him give you a short
version. Oh, well, all right. We'll see if that'll suffice. And then
if
not, we'll come back.
Right, I'll tell you.
There we go.
In February of 1940. Before February of 1940, she and her best girlfriend, named Corky, went to a religious camp, a Christian camp, up in Sherman, Texas. And from my church, two good buddies of mine went to the same camp. and among about six different couples of them, they all met and kind of shined to each other up there. Well, her best girlfriend, Clark, and my best girlfriend, Emery.
His boyfriend. Your boyfriend.
continued to date when he came back from that camp in Dallas. And Corky invited me and my girlfriend at the time, named Betty, who I was almost engaged to come to her house and play Monopoly. So before I was gathered and opened the Monopoly game, and behold, the dice weren't there. So Corky said, "Emery, you've got to go up to Minnie Mae's house, about a quarter mile away from Love Field, and get the dice. This game is Minnie Mae's." So here we go, Emery and I, knock on this front door. Here comes this lovely vision, vision of loveliness. A hundred little pin curls, bobby pins all over her head.
I didn't know they were coming.
You weren't ready for visitors.
That's another story.
He thinks it was set up.
A house dress on, fluffy house shoes. We got the dice and walked back to the car. I said to Emery, "You've got to get me a date with that, not her, with that." So we went back and played Monopoly. And later, Corky invited Emery and me back to her house to play Monopoly and invited me to make.
No Betty this time.
No Betty. No, we left her out.
So during this game, Minnie Mae said, "My mother is giving me my 18th birthday party at a nice park in Dallas, Lee Park, which is very nice. It has a nice kind of a ballroom type hall that you can rent.
Arlington, it's just like that, right?"
"And would you like to come to my birthday party?" And I said, "Sure, when is it?" She said, "April 8th. I said, "Oops, sorry, my mother's giving me a birthday party the same night with my Sunday school class guys to play 42 and have homemade ice cream." Well, a little silence there. She said, "Well, when you all finish playing 42 and have your ice cream, why don't you bring your guys over?"
That's fascinating.
I guess you caught that very quickly.
It's about six or eight of us. These South Oak Cliff boys, about 12 miles away from here.
Right, right.
Came barging into this party, and those North Dallas guys didn't like this at all. But anyway, we had a good time, so that kind of broke the ice, and we started dating. And by mid-1940, we were beginning to talk about marriage. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, first of all, she was going steady with a guy named Homer Whitley. Uh-oh. So she dropped Homer.
I had to get rid of him.
So by mid-1940, we were talking about marriage. But we were also hearing and reading that there was a possibility of a draft in late 1940. So we said, "I'm 21. We might... I might be drafted, so let's wait and see what happens, because if there is a draft, I don't want to be married and leave you here." So we decided to wait. But in September, they had the big fishbowl drawing up in Washington, pulling their numbers out. And my number was pulled out to be January, February of 41, with the first draft out of Dallas being November of 40. We talked about it, and I said, "Why don't I volunteer for this first draft? Get that year out of the way, and then come back, and we'll save 3 or 4 months before we get married." Mm-hmm. So we did that. I was in the first draft out of Dallas. And November 26, 1940. And before that year was up, Congress passed another law that says you're in for the duration. So that's how we met.
That kind of scotched the plans about you would come back after a year.
Yeah.
It did.
And so when did you actually get married then?
Okay, I was stationed in San Antonio at Fort Sam Houston in the field artillery.
Now that was your basic, had you gone to basic there?
I went to basic, yes.
At Fort Sam?
In 1940 and got out of there in January.
Field artillery.
Mm-hmm. In one of those 15th field artillery. Mm-hmm. and made corporal while there. And immediately after Pearl Harbor, in December 41, I heard about the aviation cadet program. So in January of 41, I went down and applied for, wait, 42. I went down and applied for aviation cadet, passed the exam, and was accepted, but had to wait for an opening, which came available in June of 42. And in the meantime, Minnie Mae had moved to Austin to be closer to me. I'd get off on maybe one weekend a month and go to Dallas to see her from 1940 on. But in early 42, her friend Anna Lee, mentioned a minute ago, Bitch's wife, had an apartment there in Austin, and she worked in the Department of Education and getting her law degree at UT.
She was going to law school?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was brave.
Yeah. And she invited Minnie Mae to come down and share the apartment, live in the apartment with her, got her a job in the Department of Education there in the capital of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Small government at that time. So that made it easier for me to get to Austin. So in May of 42, I was home on leave, already planning to think about getting married.
Mm-hmm.
I went out and bought a ring without her knowledge. I went to her mother, who we were just like this, and I said, Minnie Mae and I are talking to marriage. Would you concur? She said, oh, yes, that's fine. So I said, well, I think I should ask Mr. Crump. She said, that would be real nice. So one day I was there while I was on this leave, and Mr. Crump said, well, I put his hat on. He said, I'm going to go down to the barn and look at my cows. So I said, may I go with you? So we went down. Is this getting too detailed?
This is wonderful.
We went down to the barn. Now I have to regress a minute. Several years before that, he had been cranking a...
Oh, years before, he had been cranking a water pump in our home in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And some way, it broke his finger, and people didn't run to the doctor all the time to do that. And blood poisoning set in.
Oh,
and
dear.
All of a sudden, you know, he had streaks and everything on his arm, and he went to the doctor, and they removed his finger about to this...
At the knuckle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second knuckle.
And now back to the barn.
Uh-huh.
I said, Mr. Crump, Minnie Mae and I have been talking about getting married, and I wonder if you would give me your permission to marry your daughter. He took, it was on his right hand, he took that little finger like that, pointed back up the house, said, you go ask her mother.
But you'd already, you cleared that one, right?
So, Minnie Mae and I were dating one of the nights there, while I was on leave. Mm-hmm. And we said, we were talking about engagement, and she said, I'll accept it, let's get engaged. We'll talk about marriage later. Well, I already had the ring in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I have to know the size of your finger. So take your class ring off and let me try it on my finger so I'll know what size it to get. And, so she gave me her class ring, and I put it on, and then I took the other ring out and put it back on her finger, and she said, that's not my class ring. Mm-hmm. And then she yelled and said, turn on the headlights.
You don't know where, she doesn't know where we were.
Well, we were parked on Shore Bottoms Lake, just north of Lovefield.
Mm-hmm.
That's another long story. Anyway, now get to that. She ran around in front of the car, and so she could see that ring, the headlights. She started yelling, I'm engaged, I'm engaged. Well, there's security in numbers, and she had about six friends parked over there, too, you know.
That was not
all these guys jumped up their boyfriends to come over and see that ring.
We were all listening to Kay Kaiser and his musical college on the radio.
So that started our engagement, and then by July we decided July was time to get married. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had already, you had just gone into the training for...
I was still in the field artillery when we were engaged.
Oh, yes.
But before we got married, I was an aviation cadet.
Okay.
I was an aviation cadet in June of 42, and we were married in July of 42.
Okay. They frowned on wives.
Yeah. They did not want wives following the husbands
sure.
and cadets because it interrupts the continuity of study and training and learning and all of that.
Sure. And so you stayed in your job in Austin?
No, I went home to Mama.
Okay. Now, would you have been allowed to keep your job when you were married?
I don't know.
Probably, yeah.
Well, I imagine because they were short of help with all the men. And Lee, of course, stopped school. Well, it was summertime. She didn't go back to school then. She did later. And then I went back to Irving, stayed with Mother and Daddy. And that was when
we went to work at North American Aviation.
Now, tell me a little bit about that.
Well,
how did that come about?
Well, Irving, where Mother and Daddy lived, had...
let me set the stage for that.
Sure.
Irving is a suburb community
about
of Dallas.
About 10 miles from Dallas,
Grand Prairie is another suburb of to Dallas. Grand Prairie had a huge bomber plant. North American Aviation had a branch plant from their California operation there.
Okay.
They were building B-24 airplanes in that plant at Grand Prairie.
Uh-huh.
So now you can take it.
Well, there was a man who worked at North American in Irving, and he was probably in the personnel some way. I don't remember his name or anything, but people were contacting him if they wanted to work.
Sure.
And there was a bus that came all around in Irving to pick up people to go to Grand Prairie, which isn't very far from Irving. And I, some way, got a job. I wasn't trained to do anything, but I was in the machine shop. And I guess I was a gopher, really, because when this person was running out of parts, I had a little clipboard, and I would write down what they wanted, and then I'd go over to the machine shop and where they were making the screws and the nuts and the bolts and everything and get the product and take it back where it was needed.
Okay.
And I worked at night. I figured I couldn't go anywhere anyway, so I worked at night.
Right.
And the bus would pick me up in front of Mother's gate
and
I would get on the bus, and then they'd bring me back to the gate.
So that was pretty convenient.
It really was.
And did you mind working at night?
No, I liked it because Mother and I had all day to play.
Okay. And what, did you sleep?
Well, a little bit.
A little bit. Okay. But you, did you make any money at all?
Well, I don't remember. I'm sure it wasn't a lot because I didn't have a very important job, but, you know, I thought I was doing my part of the war. You know, I felt like I was doing something.
And you were doing something.
Yeah, not much, but it was something.
Now, how many women were working in the plant?
A lot. A whole lot.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were really Rosie the Riveter. I didn't do anything quite that good, but it was interesting. And it was nice to be, you know, watching them build the airplanes.
And involved. I mean, you must have felt involved.
Yeah.
Especially since he was going to now be a flyer.
Yeah.
So that kind of probably felt good.
Yeah, it did. So, you know, it just gave me something to do while I was
there. Well, sure, too. Yeah.
And Mother and I were good friends, and we'd go shopping and everything in the daytime.
Uh-huh.
So.
Now, what about your sister?
My sister is the youngest of the family. She's 7 years younger than I am.
Okay.
And she was a little princess. We all just, you know, did for Nancy. She, right now, she's and I are the best of friends. And
Does she still live in the Dallas
area? She's in Irving now, by the way. They live in Las Colinas, which is a lovely part of that.
I know exactly where that is. Yes, it's very nice.
She, of course, was in high school.
Right.
And when the war was over and he got out, we went back to Irving and rented an apartment. And she was a cheerleader. And we were really wanting an apartment, and they were hard to come by. She came home one day and she said, our advisor's leaving and our pep squad needs somebody. Would you take it? I didn't know one thing about being a pep squad advisor. But to get that lady's apartment, I said I would do it.
Sure enough. Sure.
So, you know, we were involved, and he would bring home the convertibles where he was working with his dad. He'd bring them home, and they'd ride around in the convertibles.
That sounds all right.
So, you know, it was a fun time.
I bet it was.
But she's in Irving now, okay. So we see each other.
Well, that's very nice, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Jim, let me ask you about the transition that you made from the artillery to wanting to be aviation cadet. Now, had the fact that you'd known her brothers, they were flyers, did that influence you at all, or why did you decide mm-hmm. to make that jump?
Since I was about that high, living in Commerce, every once in a while, maybe once every couple of weeks, airplane fly over. And I'd watch that thing and it just disappeared. I always wanted to fly. In fact, in 1937, when I graduated from high school, I went out to a little airport in the southern part of Oak Cliff and took flying lessons in a little Piper Cub. I soloed it after 5 hours, and then I had 40 horsepower, 40 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got a 40-mile-an-hour head thing just to still on the ground.
And that can happen in Texas,
really,
too.
Really, yeah. So I wanted to graduate to a little higher level flying. I got into a Spartan C-3, which was an open cockpit biplane, 225-horsepower engine, and it flew about 60 or 80, maybe 90 miles an hour. So that was my interest in aviation. And then when I went in field artillery, well, it wasn't even a possibility.
Right.
Because I didn't have a college education. That's all they were taking initially until the war got to where they had to back down and get the people who didn't have college education. So the transition from field artillery to aviation cadets was very simple. After I passed the cadet examinations, both physical and mental, and was accepted, and my battery commander and field artillery supported me 100%, except he said, I don't know why I put in for OCS in the Army at the same time.
Uh-huh.
He said, I don't know why you're accepting this. All those guys do is drink. And he was the biggest drunkard in the world. But that's not the story. But when I got my orders to go into the cadets, I went to Brooks Field in San Antonio, and I was a corporal, and that was considered a non-commissioned officer in those days. And the first thing I saw was an Air Force Staff Sergeant, Air Corps Staff Sergeant, mm-hmm. mowing a lawn.
Oh boy.
Not his lawn, and I said, Staff Sergeant mowing. And I said, man, I can't go over this, and I'm glad I'm a cadet.
Right.
Anyway, I went through cadet training and had no problems at all. I had to go to what was called the San Antonio Aviation Cadet Center, Kelly Field, which is now Lackland Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
But and that was our pre-flight training. And I think we were there about 3 months. And then we moved to Ballinger, Texas, to a little civilian-operated, Army-controlled airfield named Ballinger, Texas, for our basic flying. We had civilian instructors, but we had military check pilots to check the efficiency of what the civilians were teaching us. And then on to San Angelo, Texas, to basic flying. And we had military instructors there, and then on to Ellington Air Force Base in Houston for advanced flying, where I flew three different type airplanes. I flew twin-engine Beech, a twin-engine Curtis, AT-10s, AT-9s,
uh-huh.
and a single AT-6 for gunnery. Single engine, and graduated from there. But going back to basic training when we were to leave basic training, they would either send you to single engine advanced or twin engine advanced. And if you're in the upper 10% of your class academically and flying wise, you got to choose which one you wanted. Otherwise, you just drop the hat. And
okay.
So I was fortunate. I got to choose. Well, I dearly, dearly wanted to fly a P-38 twin engine. So I chose twin engine. So when I graduate, I get orders to go to Midland, Texas, to fly bombardier cadets in AT-11s.
Which are the
trainers.
Right, okay.
For the bombardiers. Mm-hmm. They carry 5 bombs on each side of the bomb bay. Two cadets and a bombardier instructor. And one cadet would drop his 5 bombs, and the other cadet then drop his 5 bombs, and then we have a little spare time maybe, and I'd give a good ride around. But that was very disconcerting to go back into a trainer airplane after mm-hmm. graduation and not get my P-38. So
yeah. Uh-huh.
I kept volunteering.
I said you didn't like me.
yeah.
I kept volunteering.
I bet you wondered.
To get out of that environment and get into a combat outfit. And she always asked me, why do you want to go fight? Well, somebody's going to fight the war or something. Anyway, but I was always declared essential. Couldn't be released.
Now, that was based on the fact that you were training people. And they needed
people.
Trainers.
Yeah.
And Jim, of course, I'm sure that wasn't, as you said, what you wanted to do, but did you see how important it was? Could you, upstairs, you could see how important it was?
I did, and later in my career in B-29s,
mm-hmm.
I realized how very important it was to me as a pilot, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
But then here came one day on the bulletin board an offer for people with for pilots with over 1,000 hours to volunteer to go into the 20th Air Force to fly B-29s. Well, nobody out where we lived ever heard of a B-29. They were so new. So I thought, well, this is an opportunity. I knew it was a 4-engine airplane. So opportunity. So I volunteered, had 1,019 hours, and I was accepted.
Uh-huh.
So before I could go to B-29, so I had to have 4-engine experience. So they sent me back to Tarrant Army Airfield, which is in Fort Worth, and I had to go through B-24 transition there for 2.5 months, and then go to my B-29 outfit. Well, they sent me to Lincoln, Nebraska to be assigned to B-29 outfit, but it wasn't ready. The base wasn't ready to accept the bomb yet, so they sent me to Tucson to be on the standardization board for B-24s.
Now, I'll stop you there for just a second. Can you tell me about that standardization board? What was the work of that group?
Okay. When a crew... When a B-29 pilot graduate and co-pilot.
Julie Bolright, please call 236.
I'm sorry, that's
funny. When a B-24 pilot and co-pilot had graduated from B-24 transition
mm-hmm.
and were going to get a combat crew, they would send them to a place like Tucson, what we call a repo depot.
A repo depot?
What all that stands for, REPEL, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, what did it stand? Doesn't matter. Anyway, that's where they would go for their training as a crew to get ready to go overseas.
They would train them together as a
yeah.
unit. Mm-hmm.
And we, as a standardization board, would ride with the crew after they passed certain phases of their crew training
mm-hmm.
to assure that they were compliant with the book.
And that they were working together? Okay.
So that they meld as a crew in combat.
Absolutely.
That was our job. And I was only there a couple of months before the B-29 base opened, and I was pulled out and sent to Great Bend, Kansas, with 19th Bombardment Group.
Now, did you know that you would only be in that standardization group for just a short time, or did you?
No, I
didn't. It wasn't certain.
No.
No, you didn't know?
My order said I was going to the 20th Bomber, uh-huh. 20th Air Force.
So this was just, you were in kind of a holding pattern, and they found this for you to do. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, in fact, when I got to Lincoln, Nebraska, they hadn't even heard of the 20th Air Force. So I had to show them my set of orders that says, you're assigned 20th Air Force.
That's new.
We got to Grade Bend, and they didn't have the B-29s for all of us to really learn right there. So they had B-17s as a companion trainer. So we had to check out the B-17 before we could get to the B-29. And then after checking out the B-29, we flew both, depending on the availability of whichever for whatever we want.
So there simply weren't enough B-29s available.
That's correct.
Jim, since you've flown the 17, the 24, and the 29, you've flown them all. Can you just put them side by side in your mind and evaluate them from a pilot's perspective?
Okay.
I think that'd be very interesting.
Okay. The B-24 was a beautiful flying airplane. It had what was called the Davis Wing, a high lift airfoil, and it flew beautifully. It could outperform in normal flight a B-17.
Meaning responsiveness to the controls.
Uh-huh. At that, plus it was faster, carry more bombs, longer range. That type of thing.
Okay.
But the B-17 was more prominent than the B-24 because the B-17 gets shot up real badly and come back home. B-24 gets shot up badly, it's going in.
Now, why was that? What was the characteristic?
I think it was just the design of the airplane and the sturdiness of the manufacturer.
So that was an engineering distinction between the two, that the B-17 could take more structural.
That's correct. Yeah.
More structural damage.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you've seen pictures of B-17s, mm-hmm. I'm sure coming in with a tail almost shot off.
Yeah.
If that happened to B-24, it's in. But that old B-17 come on back. But it was slow. I shouldn't say slow. 150 miles an hour. And it didn't carry near the bomb load that B-24 did, and it didn't have the range of B-24. Huh. But I love the B-24 more than B-17, but I would not have wanted to have taken the B-24 to combat.
Just because of its relative fragility. I mean, it's more fragile.
Now, the B-17 compared to the B-29, the B-29 was so far advanced in technology in those days. It was unbelievable what we were flying with in those days compared to what the guys in Europe were with their B-17 early in the Pacific too, with their B-17 and B-24.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the comparison.
What made that B-29 the aircraft that it was? What were the changes? What were the upgrades that made it just beyond the others?
Well, it was a much larger airplane.
It's huge,
Huge. Would fly, cruise at 210 miles an hour. Over the park, we'd go 260 miles an hour. And it was pressurized, which we could fly at high altitude without the oxygen mask on, always hanging on our helmet right beside in case we depressurize. And it had remote control gun turrets so that the guys weren't standing there doing this. Instead, they had optical type gun sights both for the bombardier, who was the forward gunner. Mm-hmm. And the right and left gunners, and the what we call central fire control gunner, who was in the center of these two, up on the pedestal, mm-hmm. looking out a dome. And that tail gunner, but he was all enclosed anyway. But these gun sights, not the tail gunner. Well, yeah, the tail gunner had the same type of gun sight. These gun sights, instead of looking through this and this,
right? Yes.
They, it, it uh, they had an optical lens, you know, with a little radical circle in it that was adjustable by size, by a knob over here. And in our study of the enemy airplanes, just the silhouettes of them, we had to learn what that airplane was just by looking at a black silhouette, and then learn what the wingspan was of it. And once it identified as this probable type, and when we're in combat now, once identified out in the distance as that type airplane, the gunner would set in, as an example, the fighter had 108 foot wingspan, set in 108, and that made the reticle 108. Well, when he then got that fighter with its wings crossways and its reticle 108, pushed a little trigger over here, and that turret would swing around and zero right
just
in.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Automatically.
Automatically. And the turret was 15 feet, 30 feet, 20 feet from where this happened. And that could be the bombardier with an upper turret, lower turret, and a nose, not in a nose, but right behind the pilot, co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be the upper lower turret and aft of the gunner side, gunner in CFC position. The central fire control gunner, he could see all around above him 360 degrees, whereas the side gunners could only see 180 their way. So
right.
He, the CFC gunner, could control who had the access to whichever turret, depending on what he could see.
Right.
If the right gunner says, I have one at 10 o'clock, well, the CFC gunner say, you got him, and flip a switch, and he had two turrets to go on him, like that. Or if the CFC gunner saw one coming at 10 o'clock high, he'd say, I've got it. He'd take something like that.
Now, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, that's, and then in addition to that, we had radar bombing capability, never heard of before. And it was a retractable turret. I know on the B-17s, you've probably seen the ball turret that they call it. But similar to that, except it's just a solid mass cover. And it can be retractable up in between the bomb bays,
mm-hmm.
up into the closure there to preclude drag, except when we're nearing the target and blowing it down, then the bombardier of the radar.
They put it down.
Put it down, mm-hmm. and have the antenna then to pick up the target and bomb by radar if the bombardier can't see the target because of clouds or whatever.
Now, during training, how much did they explain to you about how that radar worked? Did they just give you a general overview?
No.
Or they put you through the paces?
Our radar operators went through school.
Okay, they had a whole separate training. School. Okay. Where was that school? Do you remember? Do you know?
No.
Okay.
Wait a minute. No. It might have been at what is now Edwards Air Force Base, then Muroc Air Force Base out of California.
Okay.
Might have been there. I'm not certain.
But that had to be all introduced, that whole training program had to be designed and introduced as the technology itself was coming in.
That's great.
Which is really quite something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put it together all in the B-29 package.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your first time that you flew a B-29?
Yes. No, the first time, I can't say exactly the first time. I can tell you this, though.
Okay.
The first, it didn't matter whether it was first, second, third,
sure.
fourth. The I got there and I got to Great Bend, Kansas in late August 1944. And it was H-O-T.
I'll bet it was.
And the B-29s had a history of, up to that time, short history, but a history of real engine problems, overheating.
Okay.
And before you take off in a reciprocating engine airplane, you have to check the magnetos. And to do that, you set the propeller RPM and the inches of mercury by the throttle to so much. And then you check the magneto, turn it to left, right, off, and see if you get as much as, I've forgotten now, I think a 75 RPM drop in the engine. You've got to go back in. had something wrong with the engine. So in doing those checks, the cylinder head temperature sitting on the edge of the runway, 212 was the maximum, as I recall, and sometimes we get up to 230, just checking the engines in hot weather. So what we'd have to do after we checked the engines, if we didn't get the drops,
right,
we would open the cowl flaps on the engines wide and taxi the full length of the runway to let the air cool the engines, hot air cooling the engines.
Right.
Come back, and if the engines were down below 212, then we could take off. But they also had terrible oil leak problems with the first engines we had.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to combat, we didn't have near that problem.
But some of the
training we did.
Was that a problem with seals, or do you know what the problem was with those oil leaks?
I think it was seals. Mm-hmm. And they were, I hate to say this, they were Dodge engines.
That's okay.
But Dodge is a good corporation.
I'm from Michigan, so you got to be careful with that stuff. But
that was basically it, were the seals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, did they and change? Go ahead.
Well, I don't know why. It was just the seals from that particular company.
Mm-hmm.
But that they're the ones that always got the fingers pointed out. And you know, I was young in those days, and I don't know the reality of whether it's just Dodge. Right. You know.
But that's what you guys heard, and that's what you were. That was a scuttlebutt.
That's who we accused.
That's right. That's right.
Did they? Someone.
That's right. Did they switch out those engines, made the later ones?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who made the later ones? Were they still Dodge?
Right. No. Right. Yeah. They were all under Wright-Patt patent.
Okay.
Wright patent. That's not right. It's a. Just a Wright engine.
A Wright engine?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's another word there. Terrible, you know.
I think you're doing pretty well. I do too. Well, how long then were you at Great Bend?
We got to Great Bend in late August of 1944, and our group was ready to go to combat in late January of 1945. And at Christmas, I took her. She was with me there.
Uh-huh.
But she flew with me after I got my wing. After I got my wing, she went wherever I went.
Okay, so you could you live on base?
No.
No. There were no
border. No such thing.
We lived everywhere and anything.
So you would just find, you would try to just find somewhere?
Yeah, we'd stay in the motel like, in Tucson.
Catch as catch can. And
yeah. If you want to interrupt right here and let before I get into
Sure.
She can tell you about housing.
Well, when it was time for him to get his wings in Ellington Field, the whole family, his mother, daddy, her friends, after all that past years, we all went to Houston mm-hmm. to the graduation. He had no idea where he was going.
Right.
People had given me going away. I'd been home all that year, just visiting him about once a month, wherever he was.
Mm-hmm.
People gave me going away parties because they didn't know if they'd ever see me again. I was going to be gone. And when he opinned his lieutenant bars and wings on him, and when he opened his orders, Fort Worth, Texas, 30 miles from my home. What a letdown.
Yeah, right. All those parties for nothing.
I think everybody wanted their presents. But anyway.
We were only there 10 days.
Yeah, oh, okay. We lived in there. We lived in a gloomy, dark, old house that rented out a room to us
okay.
in Fort Worth.
A boarding house yeah. without meals.
I don't know where it was. I'd like to know now, but I didn't
you
remember
don't recall
where it was. But we were there just a short time. And I'll have to tell you something funny, though. He was sleepy. He was flying and everything at different hours. And one morning, I was supposed to wake him up, and he was so tired that night.
Now, let me interrupt. I need to set the timing here. When I graduated, we went to Tarrant Army Airfield, Fort Worth. And I was there about 10 days, then got orders to go to Midland.
Right.
Just with ever getting into B-24 there. And then from Midland, we came back there to get my 4-engine training.
Oh, was that from the time?
Aspirations we had to talk
okay.
about.
Okay. I was mixed up on which time it was. Anyway, I hated to wake him up. He was so tired when he went to bed.
Okay.
And he told me to wake him up at a certain time, but I was going to let him sleep a little while longer. And finally, when I woke him up, he was scared that he was going to be late. And I never let him sleep anymore. That was a no-no.
Yes.
But I just hated to wake him up. I found out later, you don't worry about that. So
you found out later, because you don't worry about
letting him sleep. You just get him up.
Get him up,
no matter how tired.
That's right.
But I was able to follow him around. We lived in Tucson and Lincoln, and in Lincoln we rented a room. A dentist and his mother rented out. They were patriotic. They rented out a room.
Mm-hmm.
I had no kitchen privileges. I could keep a little carton of milk and a sweet roll or something, because he flew different hours at night and all. And the Y wasn't very far from there.
I didn't fly at night then. Mm-hmm. Didn't fly then.
No, you were in Lincoln?
Administrative week for assignment.
Well, anyway, we ate our meals at the Y. And
now, did they have a cafeteria there at the Y that you could go? And did you just pay for what you... what you selected?
Yeah.
Is that how it worked?
Mm-hmm. And we had friends that were in the same outfit, or same boat. They lived across the street in someone else's home, and so we jumped around with them.
Okay. And how did you get back and forth to the Y?
Well, he had a car.
Had a car.
His dad gave him a car when he graduated.
Okay.
Let me interject here. Go way back now.
That's interesting. Uh-huh.
That we've kind of skipped over. When... just before I got my wings, my dad realized that I'd probably be going into combat. And that's when he made the first overture to us.
Now, he had not been in the picture. And how was he keeping track of what you were doing? Do you
through his sister, I imagine.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Because they were
closer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, my dad then.
He's going to put in an appearance now? And
yeah, he put in an appearance.
Okay.
He had an automobile salvage business in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
Very, very lucrative. I shouldn't say very lucrative.
It was the largest one in the South.
And,
but he did all right.
He did all right. So when I was in advanced flying at Ellington Field, he gave her a little Studebaker Champion to bring to me for my graduation present.
Wow. Bright red.
That's
wow.
1940 model.
Oh boy, I bet you wish you had that now.
So that's a sign of how we got back together.
Yeah.
And then after
then
we became pretty close.
Yeah. Okay. And later on you worked with him for a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that right?
After
I thought you mentioned
that later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
But anyway, we lived in very funny situation.
And I'll bet you had
to. Little Studebaker to get it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And in Midland, when we went there, it was my job to go find a place to live when he reported in. And it was hard. There was one apartment house in Midland, if you can imagine. And I guess we found this through the grapevine or something. Anyway, we moved in there. All military people were there.
Mm-hmm.
12 apartments.
Mm-hmm. 12 apartments in this one. It's still there.
Is that right?
It has a new name and it's been improved, but it's still there. We visited the area not long ago.
How interesting.
And
that must have been a funny feeling too.
And all the, you know, the wives would chum around together.
Sure.
And all young and no children and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see in Tucson we lived in a motel room, and in Lincoln in the dentist's office, his mother's home. Where else were we? In Great Bend, we lived in what had been a little grocery store connected to a house.
Uh-huh.
They figured they could make more money renting it out than a grocery store.
Uh-huh.
And
wow.
A lot of details.
Actually, it wasn't in Great Bend, it was in a little community. A few miles from Great Bend, had two or three grain silos.
And the railroad track.
And the grocery,
track.
Yeah, railroad track by a grocery store and about
a one-room schoolhouse
back then. And a little schoolhouse.
Tiny.
But we were happy to have it.
I bet you.
And when we, I went into the newspaper office to see if there was any ads in the paper. And a young airman was being transferred, and he had an apartment in this place, and I overheard him trying to put an ad in the paper, and I followed him outside, and he told me what it was, and I said, could I look at it? So I took him in our car and took him out there. It was what was the name of that little
Dundee.
Hmm?
Dundee,
Kansas. And It was like one room had been the store, and they had one little partition for a bedroom, two walls, you know. Our bed was in there. And I was so glad to find somewhere. I didn't even look around, really. Come to find out, we had no sink. We had a dish pan with a faucet. We had a little bathroom to take a shower. We went down the basement, shared with someone else down, lived down there. And it was a place to live.
And you were in charge of finding
a place.
And just you, that was your department.
That's right.
And once you would find a place, and you didn't really know how long you were going to be at any of these places, what did you do? You were probably very busy managing the food and trying to get all that arranged.
Yeah, and everything we owned, we could put in that little Studebaker.
Yeah.
You should see us now.
Yeah. you've accumulated
like
a few
things. But anyway, we managed just fine.
Sure, sure.
And they had big lights like a little grocery store would have in the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
And when you came in, you turned one switch and the whole place, you know.
It would light up.
They had a lot of coal oil lamps, kerosene lamps sitting up there. And I said to the lady that was showing me the place, "Why do you have those up there?" And she said, "Our power goes off real often." So, but it was, you know, it was a nice place to live. We made do.
You made do.
And that's it got cold while we were there, you know.
Well, just as it gets hot up there,
yeah,
it gets cold.
We took our milk from a local farmer, and they brought it to us in the glass milk bottles with a little cardboard stopper.
Sure.
And it was so cold, you know, the cream would freeze and raise up about that high over.
They just sit on steps.
Yeah, that's enough about it.
That's right.
But let me tell you about housing. When we rolled in the Great Bend from Tucson, where B-24s, we went into the hotel hoping to get a room. No room at the inn. So, but they were very, very accommodating. They called a little town of Washington, which is just north of Great Bend, and they said, "Yeah, we have one room. You can have it for 3 nights." I said, "We'll be there." So we got there and checked in, and we're on the second floor, and tied to the bedstead is a coil of rope with little knots in it. Minnie Mae looked at me and she said, "What's that?" I said, "That's your fire escape." And it was.
Not kidding.
That was a way to get out if you had to get out.
We were on second floor this
whole time. We had 3 nights there because of housing shortage. They wouldn't let anybody long term in a hotel. They just rotated them.
Wow.
And fortunately, she was able to get us in this place in Dundee.
I mean, it's just almost unimaginable now.
It built character.
Yes, ma'am. I think you're right. I think you're right. Well, you had to solve a lot of problems. And once you had them solved, you weren't done because you had to, the next time it was going to be a whole new set of circumstances. You probably had to become very self-sufficient and confident, I would think, too. I mean, she had to on her own.
Well, you didn't want to worry them. They had more serious things to worry about.
Well, yeah, that's right. You were fully engaged in the training process, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Well, let me ask you a couple of timeline questions, and this will kind of help set your own personal experiences against the broader background. At the end of 1944, when you were up in Kansas, I'm sure you were paying as much attention as you could, given all of your engagements, to what was happening in the war. And of course, you had two brothers who had gone missing, and you had no information, so that's very worrying. But at that time, did you know whether you were going to be deployed to the European theater, where the Battle of the Bulge, for example, was taking place, or out to the Pacific?
Didn't know.
Had no idea?
No. When we finished our B-29 training at Great Bend and were getting ready to deploy overseas, they told us pack summer and pack winter, and they gave us winter clothes or summer clothes. And you don't know where you're going and don't even speculate. And they let us ship a footlocker, a wooden
About like that.
Mm-hmm. Of anything we wanted to our overseas base. This is one advantage of being an Air Corps, yes. Rather than
yes,
on
yes,
the ground
sir.
Where you carry everything you know.
Yes, sir.
But so my crew, we packed everything we wanted, thought we'd want overseas, and that was shipped. We didn't know where, but we they put us on a train and sent us to. Well, I'll regress. Several of the crews flew their own airplanes out of Great Bend. I was a junior. I was still a second. No, I was first lieutenant, but I just made first lieutenant in December of '44. So I was a junior aircraft commander, and my crew didn't get an airplane to fly overseas. We put on a train and headed west to Hamilton Field, just north of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were there a couple, 3 days, I don't remember exactly, and they put us on a C-54 transport, and I didn't know whether we were going to Alaska or whether we were going to Panama or whether we were going to Pacific somewhere.
Just had no clue.
Had no idea. But we did have, but when we got on the airplane, they gave me a set of orders, my whole crew. Don't open this for 2 hours after you're off this base. So we opened it in Guam. So we landed in Honolulu and Johnson Island and mm-hmm. maybe Quonset, I don't know what. Anyway, we finally got to Guam.
Let me ask, before I ask you about Guam, what did you do?
Well, he took me home at Christmas time.
Yeah.
And I stayed with Mother and Daddy again.
Okay, okay.
And
that was the plan that you mm-hmm. had devised, that she would stay.
They always seemed glad and had me home. I don't know where they were.
I'm going to guess they probably were. I'm going to guess they were. Let's take a break for just a second.